is most recently the author of The Fry Chronicles. Stephen, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well. I'm having a nice day of gentle publicity. I've done, Charlie Rose in the morning and some nice people at NPR, WNYC, and I've had lunch. And people have been nice and chatted to me about my book. And so far, no one has attacked me morally or spiritually or in any other way. And I suppose this is where it all changes.
Right now, we've got the closed doors. We're in an office. We're in a very serious journalistic capacity. Well, I'm curious. You recently just had to capitulate your iPhone. How many gadgets do you have on you right now, out of curiosity?
Well, I've still got one other iPhone,
an iPad,
and a BlackBerry in there.
I saw your fingers clawing onto the iPhone as they dragged the one that needed to be charged away from you. I mean, can you go to bed without something on you? Or?
Yes, I can. I read books in bed, physical books in bed. I read Kindles or Kindle books on an iPad or indeed on a Kindle when I'm traveling. And then that's as much as anything, without wishing to be sententious and typical actor, the fact it's actually just laziness. You may remember from your physics lessons at school that the atom is that thing with a big little nucleus, and around the nucleus
there's an atom.
Yeah,
you have to understand this is American public
of
education.
Course.
Yeah,
and you know there's a little thing in the middle of the nucleus, and around the nucleus there fly things called protons and neutrons, and and one of them is called an electron.
Yes,
and the electron has a negative charge and no mass and a spin, and it's no accident we use the word electronic to describe our gadgets. And an e-book is an electronic book. It has no mass. Now, when I say that, you may say, well, who gives a hoot? If I take three books, we're in here, publisher's office, and all the books around us, almost all of them are hardcovers. If I took three of them in my luggage, that would be quite a weight.
Yes.
I can take a Kindle or an iPad, which has 2,000 books on it, or zero books on it, and it will weigh exactly the same. Now, when people are traveling around the world reading, whatever you may think about e-books, we've all heard but I like the smell of books, and yes, well, so do I, and I like the illustrations, I like the physicality of them. The great Anthony Powell once wrote a book whose title was Books Do Furnish a Room.
Yes.
And, you know, they do furnish a room. They're beautiful objects. But the idea that one thing replaces another is just a misunderstanding of the way humans develop. You know, we didn't get rid of stairs once someone invented the escalator or the elevator.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't get rid of radio once cinema came along.
Yeah.
In fact, more people listen to the radio now than have ever done in the history of
the
medium.
There's more radio than you know what to do with.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. More people, and the people still watch television.
There's more content than what you know what to do with.
People still go to movies. Yeah. People, you know, the fact is, things complement each other in ways that we can't necessarily predict, in ways that we can't be absolutely sure we can control, or at least the companies that used to have control can't be sure they can control.
Yeah.
So when it comes to things like newspapers, of course, your Murdochs and your other figures, and the recent documentary on the New York Times showed, there is terror that the Deadwood, as I call it, press is over. And in a few years it will be. But that doesn't mean that smart people who want to tell the world about what's going on in the world won't have a trusted platform.
Yeah.
And that's the point, is a trusted platform. How do you... is the New York Times a trusted platform? Well, yes, it is if you live in New York and you live in, let's say, Midtown or in Brooklyn or in a nicer loft somewhere down in Chelsea. Of course, the New York Times is a trusted platform. But it isn't if you live in Albuquerque or you live in if you live in Texas or you live in South Carolina. It's the last thing in the world that's a trusted platform. So the point is, there's nothing is absolute in these terms.
Yeah.
Now, things can be facts. I think we can accept as fact, unless we are really weirdly paranoid, that Colonel Gaddafi is dead. That it may have been an accident that he was actually shot when he was, but that he is dead. He probably would have been tortured and beaten and maybe put on trial. But now you can read that in the New York Times, or you can read it on CNN online, or you can watch it on TV or listen to it on the radio. There is hard news. Who is analysing the hard news? How well are they analysing it? How many people are being sent out and being embedded with armed forces? And how many people, how much is just being pooled. How much is it all Reuters and AP? It's no longer can Peter Jennings say, we go to our correspondent.
Yeah.
You know, that, all that is, yes, that is going to change.
On the other hand, you now have to start a Kickstarter campaign if you wish to be embedded yes. in a war zone. I mean, now we're dealing with a situation in which money...
Yeah.
You need money to create journalism. You need money to get that in-depth coverage. And now, you know, even you, in the post-internet age, now have to generate a lot of tweets, a lot of amusing bones.
Well, whether I have to or not, I don't know, because I don't feel I have to. People may not believe it. I'm not a number chaser. I don't care how many followers I have. And that's simply the good fortune is, not because I'm a prophet of anything of the nature, is I joined Twitter more or less when it started. And so people in Britain, at least, certainly very quickly began to associate it with my name because I was the first so-called celebrity to be on Twitter. And so people thought when they joined Twitter, oh, I better follow Stephen Fry.
Yes.
And so my numbers built up. You know, 30,000 seemed enormous at one point. And then someone said, you're going to hit 50,000. And then someone said, oh, my God, you're going to hit 100,000. And then suddenly, and now it's, you know, in probably 3 weeks, I think, so you can work it out pretty accurately, I'll be at 4 million. Well, the great thing about that is that's more than the circulation of any newspaper in Britain.
Sure.
So it means I don't have to give a single print interview for the rest of my life, and I never, ever will, ever. Not even to a student journalist or anything, because they get syndicated and passed on and bought up and misquoted, and there's no need to. If people want to think I'm an a-hole, they can think so by listening to my voice and deciding it.
Yes.
Not filtered through some journalist.
Yes.
You know, and so, but things are different, and I appreciate that there is such a thing as honourable journalism, news reporting. There have been people in the world, either through photojournalism or through written verbal journalism, who have saved lives, who have made us conscious of starvation, of bullying, of tyranny, who've kept us awake to the terrible things that are going on. I'm also aware, incidentally, that there are terrorist groups who rely on journalism for their success. And that may be the fact that nobody actually bothers to read the New York Times or the Washington Post or anymore, the LA Times anymore, the Chicago Tribune or whatever the big names are over here. Maybe that's actually rather annoying to your Shiite and your Sunni, who's actually just blown up a mosque full of 30,000. It's not even made the front page.
Yeah, yeah.
And that actually could be a good thing, because a lot of us, haven't we often thought, actually all we need to do to stop terrorists is deprive them of the oxygen of publicity and just not report it. Obviously, you couldn't not report the Twin Towers. It was too horrible to I mean,
too visible. All of a sudden, the Manhattan skyline changes. It's hard to kind of stay silent. There seems to be smoke over there.
You can't hide that one. Yeah. And of course, there will always be paranoid theories when I know people who live in a street and they hear a lot of police cars and emergency vehicles, and then the next day there's nothing in the newspaper, and they immediately think that a Bilderberg group full of lizards who run the world is responsible for it.
Well, tying these multifarious observations with what is in your book, I actually wanted to ask you about this intriguing period when you were in Cambridge.
Yes.
You describe how you were cheating on essays because you wrote all of the essays in advance in your head, to the point where you were able to cite chapter and verse, specific lines down to the line number of Shakespeare, specific critical reference works down to the publisher, the edition, whether it was in hardcover, rather extraordinary, and that you would actually tilt these essays in relation to the question that was asked of you.
That's the point.
Yes.
Exactly. The point is, if you have an essay on Othello, or you have an essay on Antony and Cleopatra, if we just stick with Shakespeare just for the sake of a closed canon so we can think about it. You have an essay on Macbeth. You have a point of view. You have I know I can deliver 3,000 words very quickly on Macbeth. If I know I can, then...
You have 45 minutes right now, man.
Right. And the question is... the essence of Macbeth is the difference between the microcosm of Macbeth's mind and the macrocosm of the real world, say. Now, that may not suit my thesis at all on Macbeth, which is actually to do with the way the poetry disintegrates as the play progresses. But I can make it exactly answer that question. Yeah. You just have to polarize. You know, it's like getting a magnet on. Did you ever have they probably were American, so I don't know why I'm asking if you had them. Those little bald men with iron filings and a magnet, and you used to make beards out of them.
I think before my time.
Probably was before my time. Yeah. But that's what you're doing. You're just taking a magnet and you're polarizing what you know. Now, it's kind of cheating. It's not cheating really, because I am passionate about Shakespeare. Yeah. I love Shakespeare. But I'm very, very lazy when it comes to exams. And I also am aware that an examination is an examination of nothing other than the ability to pass an exam. And what use is that? Mm-hmm. You might as well say, in order to qualify from Harvard University, you have to win a squash match. Or you have to do the best Lady Bracknell of your year. Then you will get your top degree. Why is the ability to reproduce prepared, pappy ideas about intellectual concepts on paper?
Yeah.
Why is that a good reason to give someone a job in a law firm, in Wall Street, or in a publishing company, for that matter? Part of my love of technology is, you see, what I would love is, of course, is to go all the way back to the days of the ancient Greeks, where you had Aristotle, and you had Plato, and you had the Lyceum, and you had the Academy. So you would actually have a master. And to me, this is how an ideal examination would go. It doesn't matter what subject the person is reading, as we say in England, or studying, as you would say here. You would just say coffee.
Yeah.
Now, someone who's reading history might just instantly start talking about the coffee shops, how they were banned by Charles II, how they then came back again under Queen Anne, and how they caused a movement in the coffee shops of Paris with Diderot and the Republic of Letters and Voltaire and the Enlightenment. Or they could talk about the secessionist Viennese coffee shops of Mahler and Klimt and so on, and Stefan Zweig and the whole generation of intellectuals, Rilke and Krauss and so on. Or you could talk about coffee as, is it an emulsion?
Yeah.
Is it a solution? How is coffee grown? What is it as a cash crop? What does it mean politically, ethically? That there are some countries who are not allowed to grow food that they can eat. They can only grow food that they can sell at currency rates. It's a geopolitical issue. It's also, you could talk about the history. Here we are in a publisher's office about the coffee table book.
Yeah.
You could talk about it as a medical student. You could talk about it as a stimulant. You could talk about caffeine.
Worker exploitation, fair trade. Yeah.
Basically, what you want, if you're examining someone, is just to give them a single word and watch them run with it.
Mm-hmm.
And watch them. One of my absolutely favorite quotations, I'll try and get it right, is from De Profundis, the letter that Oscar Wilde wrote in prison to his lover, Lord Alfred Douglas, Bosie, as he nicknamed him, the man who basically destroyed his life, the boy who destroyed his life. And at one point, he's talking about Oxford, and he says, the fact that you didn't get a first-class degree is no disgrace. Many first-class minds never achieved first-class degrees. The fact that you didn't get any degree at all is no disgrace. Many first-class minds never finished their courses and got their degrees. But what to me, Bosie, is unforgivable is that you never achieved what I believe used to be called, puts in inverted commas, the Oxford manner. And he then says, which I take to mean the ability to play gracefully with ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that the most beautiful definition of education you've ever heard? The ability to play gracefully with ideas. So whether the idea be coffee, whether it be paper, whether it be homosexuality, whether it be floorboards, it doesn't matter. Because intelligence is about connection.
Yes.
Whereas an exam question that just says, discuss Shakespeare's use of imagery in Measure for Measure. Well, come on.
But it's actually much worse here in America. I'm sure you're familiar with the No Child Left Behind Act, which is imposing these draconian standards and is absolutely convinced that all schools can offer 100% competence adhering to these standards. And as a result, and there's a great book by Diane Ravitch called The Death and Life of Great American School Systems, which outlines what's been going on, which means that if the school doesn't meet these draconian standards, It gets sanctioned. It can fire teachers and administrators who are considered to be failures, and so
forth.
In
me, yeah. The pedant in me would say that Draco was a leader of the Greek Republic at a time when every single crime was punishable by death,
which
is what Draconian really means. And I'm sure it isn't Draconian in that sense.
But when the Oxford know, Manor is in opposition to something
what you
like
mean.
This, I mean, you know, it's sort of difficult.
And even more in opposition to that is the other group of people, which are tend to be the right-wing industrial nexus, whatever you might call them, those who have influence over politics, who say that education actually is irrelevant. What matters is vocational training.
Yeah.
And so they want people with MBAs, they want people with apprenticeships, they want people who don't have a wide, broad education and ability to play with ideas, but who can do very specific things, like training. It's training. And you think of that in terms of a tree. You know how you used to train a fruit tree against a wall. You straighten out its branches, you staple them to the wall so that it's... And it bears fruit very efficiently. Now, we're human beings, we're not fruit trees, and we're certainly not there to have ourselves straightened out to produce fruit for the state. We're here to question, to wonder, to oppose.
But you are extending your arms very impressively, resembling a branch. So,
thank you very much. I did do
so. I think that if you wanted to be a fruit tree, you could. You have a good line in that.
I've certainly been a good fruit, whether or not I'm a tree. And of course, by their fruits shall ye know them. But you know, the education point is a really interesting one, and I don't know what the answer to it is. I think, oddly enough, if I am educated, if I have an education, it's obviously one I've given myself, because that's what, by definition, all educations are.
Yeah.
They are, you know, you're drawn out, nothing's put in, you're not a bucket that is filled by a good teacher. And one of the saddest things is when people say, oh, well, Shakespeare was ruined for me at school because I had a terrible Shakespeare teacher. I always say back to them, yeah, it's the Alps for me. I had this awful geography teacher. I just find the Alps so dull because I had this awful geography teacher. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I think it's either beautiful or it isn't. You can't blame a teacher for not being able to communicate its beauty. I can look at the Alps and see they're beautiful. And if you can't look at Shakespeare and see it's beautiful, don't blame a teacher.
Yeah.
Blame yourself for not looking hard enough. And I know people don't want to hear that, but that's the answer.
And you get into that in the book, and I actually wanted to discuss this further. I mean, I'm in agreement that, okay, we are in a world of riches. We have more information available to us at any point in human history. Yet at the same time, I mean, you know, learning about apple trees, Shakespeare, or whatnot, this requires time. And if you are someone who is working two jobs, who is raising a kid, you know, how do you factor that into your dismissal?
Because I'm a gay actor who doesn't do much.
No, I'm only kidding.
I know you weren't. But it is funny. Yeah. I have to say, I don't mean this in a boastful way, but I have yet to share diaries with someone who is busier than I am.
Mm.
And I'm including politicians here. I've had meetings recently. I'm trying to get...
Including politicians like who?
Well, politicians always say that every single hour of every day is taken up by...
Even the bathroom breaks and all that.
Yeah, et cetera. And of course, they are to some extent busy. But they're not busier than me because that's actually all stuff that's done. And then when it's done, it's done. If you're a writer and you have other things, it's never finished.
Yeah.
And I am a very, very busy person. But you may notice I'm quite tubby. It's because I'm greedy. And if people say they don't know anything, it's only because they're not greedy.
Yeah.
They're not greedy for knowledge.
Yeah.
I sometimes an image I give is imagine that, like Dick Whittington, the mayor, really was told when he was a child, go to London because the streets are paved with gold. Imagine if in fact, in every city, the sidewalks, as you call them here, the pavements were piled high with gold coins, and you had to, it made a noise, it made a sort of clattering noise as you shuffled your way through it, and it was terrible. And then you bumped into a beggar standing up with his hat out, saying, please, please, give me some money, I'm poor, I can't eat. You'd look at him and go, what? Look around you, just bend down and pick it up.
Yes.
And that's what I feel when people say, oh, it's all right for you, you know these things, you went to Cambridge and were taught things, so but why can't I don't know about all this stuff. I just want to say, but bend down and pick it up. It's never been more available. All it takes is greed.
You are in a country where most Americans don't have a passport. You are in a country where they actually don't know these options. I'll give you a perfect existential example of my own. So the New York Public Library, if you go in that marvelous reading room, capacious tables, everything, it's like, of course, I'm going to totally study because this is the environment totally made to not slack off in any way, right?
Yes.
But if you try to find a seat at a coffee house now, every single table is completely filled up with people with their laptops, and there's often people who sit down and they have these like board meeting vernacular, and you can't get anything done. I mean, it's to the point where it's almost a Trail of Tears-like situation for me and my friends. You know, we have to go to the next coffee house before they discover it, right? But you can pretty much almost always get a seat at the New York Public Library. And the question is like, what do we do to restore the balance, to get people understanding that, yes, the streets are paved with informational gold if you go ahead and reach down and pick it up? What do you think?
To me, and this is simply prejudice. It's prejudice that comes from the gifts that nature never gave me, and they were coordination and music. Although I love music and I'm passionate about music, and I listen to music every day and I collect music, I have musical heroes, distinct and different. I mean, they're not all, it may be known by some that I made a film about Richard Wagner, which was very important to me, partly because as a Jewish person, Wagner is always going to be problematic if you love him, because he was such a bestial anti-Semite, and of course, although that was not his fault, because he died 50 years before, literally 50 years before Hitler became Chancellor of Germany. Hitler happened, of course, to adore Wagner too. So there's music. I do love music, but I can't do it. I can't perform it. I can't sing. I can fiddle off the. I can play the odd note on the piano. But
can you dance?
Absolutely cannot dance. Not even begin to put myself in a position.
Have you tried to take ballroom dance lessons?
I would hate it. I would loathe it, the subconscious.
Come on, Stephen, pick it up. The dance is right there.
If you've read my book, you will know my physical self-consciousness is extreme. But bad as this sounds, and this is not a complaint, the fact that I was so incompetent, so uncoordinated physically, so ungifted musically, meant that all I had to give myself any pride was language.
Yeah.
It's all I had. And the odd thing is, that's all any of us have. It is the miracle of the human species. Nobody knows why, but for some reason, a very recent time, 50,000 years ago, our brains changed and we were able to do something that no other animal can come close to doing. The communications and things that birds can make and that other primates can make do not approach language. I know you've spoken to Steven Pinker, and you'll I can't quite call him a friend, but he's an email buddy, and we communicate, and I admire him enormously. We don't agree on everything, and there are other wonderful linguists like Guy Deutscher, I'm not sure if you're familiar with, but there are many, and obviously the great hero himself, and Chomsky. Language is the proper study of mankind, and it is our miracle, our sense that we suddenly, above all creatures, were able to develop a communicatory system which was more than just gesture. It had tenses in it. Now you may say, well, why is a tense important? It could imply futurity. You could use your mouth and the sounds that come out of it, or your hands if you're deaf, because this deaf language is true language too, to suggest 3-4 days in the past or 2 weeks in the future. You could say, let us meet at that place where we killed that buffalo 3 weeks ago. Let's meet there in 7 days' time. Mm-hmm. Now that immediately, it sounds so simple, but an animal may be able to be taught to do something for food or sex, which is basically all they do. Now, it may be that most of what humans do is for food or sex too, but there's a lot in between.
Yeah.
And the sense of futurity allows the possibility of a civilization. It allows the ability to plan, to farm, to build a city, to trade. And then once the Phoenicians got in on the idea of writing, from the movement from cuneiform, Assyrian cuneiform, and an alphabet, which the Phoenicians invented, as I'm sure you know, once you could have that, then suddenly a whole civilization is born and a whole new way of looking at the world. It all comes from language. Now, I don't know much about hip-hop. I don't know much about I'm not a DJ.
I've seen you rap on Who's Lines Anyway, yeah.
I'm not much of a rapper. But one of the things that excites and interests me about it is that it does actually inculcate in youth a respect for, a delight in language. And that's really all I'm after. We all delight in dance, in paint, in beauty, in the erotic, in the sublime, in all kinds of ways. But we very, very easily forget to delight in the beauty of language, simply the sound of the tongue hitting the tip of the teeth and the tongue is in itself a miraculous and extraordinarily beautiful thing. The fact that this sentence I'm starting to speak now, Edward, I have no idea where it's going to end, what word it will end with. It may well end with the word hummingbird. It did, as it turned out. Where does that all come from? And that's the liberation. That is more than money. If you can communicate, if you can use language with joy and certainty and confidence, then that is worth more than almost all the gold in the world.
But it is interesting to me that your facility with language, which I would argue is based around a sort of Woodhouseian rhythm,
is
musical only in that form. But when you actually gravitate towards music, not so much.
Not in the least. I don't claim to be musical.
No,
language at all. I certainly appreciate the rhythms, the clausulae, as Cicero might put it, of language. Which indeed was Woodhouse would appreciate as a classical scholar. Sure. Woodhouse himself would say he owed it to a mixture of Thucydides, Cicero, Tacitus, and W. H. Gilbert. S. Gilbert, I beg your pardon, William Schwenk Gilbert, whom he admired enormously, and indeed Arthur Conan Doyle. There are rhythmical, and indeed Wilde.
Yes.
The rhythms are the importance of being earnest. The language in there is somewhere between a dance. I mean, I remember watching the film The Importance of Being Earnest when I was a boy, and there was that moment where Algernon says, "Would you be offended if I said that you seem to me to be in every way the visible personification of absolute perfection?"
Yes.
And I remember thinking, oh, God, this thing that I thought we used to pick up the phone and say, can I have a pizza, or ask someone where's the nearest toilet, can be made into a musical instrument, or more than that, or a paintbrush, or a dance motif. It is in and of itself a thing of astounding beauty. It can seduce, beguile, charm, enchant, and delight, as well as do all the dreadful things that we know it can do. And that's an important, is to think of the exact negative. I don't believe, as a whether as a Jew or not, why should I say as a Jew? It's irrelevant, but I say it anyway.
You've been very identity cleaving.
Yeah, I am.
Because I'm gay, because I'm Jewish.
Come on. I say this as a gay Jew who hangs to the left and has a size 14 feet. I say that I don't think...
I say this as a bald man right now.
I don't think the shower would not have been possible without first the linguistic linguistic go. That was the point. There was no argument you could make against Jews. I mean, of course, you could. You could say somehow, amazingly, they were responsible both for capitalism and for communism.
Yes.
They were doubly guilty for two opposite sins.
But all sorts of wonderful
sins.
Broadway turns as well. Yeah.
Well, they didn't, let's face it, they didn't do that. But in all seriousness, if we're talking about the rise of anti-Semitism the culmination of what had been rising since the 1890s in Vienna and in Munich, that kind of anti-Semitism. What it needed was the Deutsche Beobachter of Julius Streicher. It needed Goebbels and it needed Hitler. It needed them for years and years to beat the drum in which the word Jew was accompanied with the word Untermensch, and it was a word like rats, lice, parasites, disease, infestation. In other words, total dehumanization. The language had... It took about 10 or 12 years... Basically, for Germans, one almost doesn't blame them to stop thinking of Jews as human beings.
Yeah.
I had, when I made the documentary about Wagner, I had the extraordinary privilege of talking to this woman, Anita Walter, Anita Lasker Walfisch, who at the age of 15 was taken to Auschwitz. And because she was such an extraordinary cellist, she was singled out to be in the cappella, the women's version of the there were two cappella. Cappella is German, it's not quite orchestra, it's got a band, I suppose, it's a small orchestra. And she played in it. And I went to interview her to talk about this Wagner. She didn't like Wagner, not because of the Nazi things, just her taste was for... She obviously survived, and when she went to Britain, she founded the English Chamber Orchestra, and that's her particular style. She told one story when she was sitting in a bunk picking lice from a friend, and a friend was picking lice from her, and it was the usual thing that you would do if you're small amount of spare time at Auschwitz, if you're a 15-year-old girl, if your mind can get around such an imponderable thing. And a man walked in, and she said, and my blood froze in my veins because I recognized him. We all knew who he was. He was very famous, and we were scared of him. And I began to feel the blood, you know, my bladder beginning to loosen. It was the camp doctor, whose name was Josef Mengele.
Yeah.
I said, what? She said, yes, Josef Mengele walked in, and he pointed at me. And I didn't know what to do. I thought, and then, thank God, he pointed at my cello, and then he curled his finger and beckoned. And I knew he just wanted me to play for him.
Yeah.
So I picked up my cello, and I followed to his office, where he was writing out papers. And I played to him. And I said, do you remember what you played? She said, of course. Yeah. I played Träumerei, which is one of, as you know, I'm sure, the most transcendently lovely pieces of music by Robert Schumann. And I said, and then when he'd finished, he said he waved me away.
Yeah.
And I said, so stupid of me, just shows how little I still understood. I said, did he thank you? Did he smile? Did he seem moved? I mean, he said, and she said, it's so funny, you still don't understand, you see. I understand why you don't understand, but I have to explain to you, we were not human beings. You don't thank your telephone after a conversation. You don't thank your computer when you've sent an email. You don't thank the door because you've closed it. We were machines. That's how they could treat us the way they did.
Yeah.
I happened to be a machine that could play music.
Yeah.
And I, you know, and it was a slap in the face to me. Of course I should have known that. You know, I've read Hannah Arendt, I've read Prima Levi, as I'm sure you have. We've all read, you know, a lot of people who are interested in such things are likely to have read what you might call Holocaust literature. But still you have to get inside your head how it is one, this imponderable question, is how one person can treat another like that. And that point she made was so good. And I then said to her, can you listen to Träumerei now? Did you still play it? She said, but of course, she said, they can cut off my leg, they can cut off my head, they can shoot me, they can cut me to pieces. Can they make Robert Schumann's Träumerei not beautiful?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Can they beat music? Never. And as it happens, it will amuse you.
A variant of the Rick Lardner rule. No good thing is made from a bad script.
Exactly. Well, it will amuse you in the world of political correctness when it comes to tobacco. She's a chain smoker.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So throughout this interview, this 80-year-old woman who had survived Auschwitz was smoking away. And I was at the BBC, and it was my company that had produced this this documentary for the BBC. And the head of the controller of the channel said, I've just heard there's an interviewee in one of in your Wagner program who's smoking. You've got to cut that out.
Really?
And I said, there's no way, she smokes all the time. He said, well, then you'll have to cut her out. You cut her out somehow. I said, there really isn't any way. He said, you know the rule. You can't have people smoking on television unless it's a documentary against smoking or something, or it's an old film. Or I said, will you do me one favor? Will you trust me this much? Can I just show you the scene?
Yeah.
As it happens, control of the channel was German, and he saw the scene, and tears fell down his eyes. He said, "You don't dare cut one frame of that."
Yeah. Why were they having such draconian standards against smoking all of a sudden? I didn't realize that it was this bad.
Which everything, I mean, they do a program called Spooks, which is like a spy show, and a friend of mine was directing it. And usually what happens is there's a terrorist in the middle of London who's about to explode a nuclear bomb or something, and our hero has to just find them in time or whatever. And so there's a scene where, and this is the first episode my friend had directed of this series. It had been running for quite a few seasons. And he gets the hero, played by Rupert Penry-Jones, rushes into the car, and he says, right, and zoom off. And, you know, I really, you know, if you can, make the back wheel scrunch on the gravel. I want a real sense of the urgency of it. There's a little tap on the shoulder from the script supervisor. He says, he must, of course, put his seatbelt on. He said he's got to go to London to save London from being blown up by an atomic bomb.
Yeah.
And he's not got the time to put his seatbelt. No, we're not allowed to have heroes driving without seatbelts.
BBC is getting just as bad as Hollywood.
And as he said, we just have seen when he shot someone in the face.
Yeah.
So we're allowed, he's allowed to shoot people in the face, but he's not allowed to drive to save 7 million people without a seatbelt. He said, well, no, they won't pass it. So he found some way to get him into the car and just pull at the seatbelt and then cut away. So when you next cut back to him, he's in the car. And then there's a scene where he has to talk to his oppo, who's in the middle of London, who's trailing this terrorist, right? And you've got all these kind of angles, these snazzy angles, Dutch, you know, all wonderful stuff, sort of flash zooms and crash zooms and all that. And you're cutting back to our hero in the car, and he then picks up the phone and starts to talk. And again, she taps him and says, no, he has to stop to talk on the phone. He can't phone. And he said, wait, he's trying to save the world.
Who are they going to corrupt? I mean, how did this seems to me sort of comparable to our standards and practices here. But I mean, how did this come into play? Is it recently, in the last like 5, 10 years?
Last 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, 10, 15 years.
The cliche phrase for it is health and safety gone mad.
How austerity measures helped things.
Or political correctness gone mad. Yeah. Or as a friend of mine once said, they've called our local loony bin now an establishment for the cerebrally challenged. He said, it's just madness gone politically correct.
Yes.
It's quite a good joke. You didn't hear it, but it's good. It is a good joke, believe me.
There's an episode in this book in which you are exploited by another notable Stephen Sondheim, so that he can use your fax machine for a scavenger hunt.
Yeah.
And this involved a lot of waiting around. The thing that gets me about this particular story is that you chose, of all books to read, Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged. So I'm wondering, you know, was this kind of a masochistic decision? Or?
No, it was just merely that I felt I had seen The Fountainhead, the movie.
Yes.
I love Gary Cooper. I love Patricia Neal, and I thought it was a wonderful movie. I thought it was weird. I thought there's something strange about this, but it is magnificent. And I saw the name of the, you know, from which the book had come. And I happened to be in a secondhand bookshop, and I saw this book, Atlas Shrugged, by the same Ayn Rand. And I thought, well, this is before the days of when I could easily have wicked her and found out that she was a Russian Jewess who'd come over and had all this theory about this.
You were
and that
operating
and the
in
other.
The dark.
You know, so I was operating in the dark. And I started to read it, and I thought, this is a deranged book. But basically, to give you the background, Stephen Sondheim loves games and sort of word games and scavenger hunts and so on. And we're in the 80s, and he asked Mike Cochran, who directed the musical Me and My Girl that I'd written the book of. He said, do you know anybody in London who's got a fax machine? And Mike instantly said my name, because, of course, I was the only person he knew who had a fax machine, which is a bit like being the only person in the world with a tennis racket. Completely useless. you've got to at least have one other friend with a fax machine. Who do you fax if you don't? If you're the only one in the world. It's a kind of logical madness. But I just love... And there were offices that, you know, and I did do a bit of journalism in those days, and so I used to fax my copy. And so Steve called me up. Steve Sondheim called me up and said, hi, it's Stephen Sondheim. And I gulped, kind of thinking, oh my God, he wants me to collaborate with him. He wants me to write a book for his next musical. I know.
Sure.
And instead he said, I understand you have a fax machine. I thought, maybe he likes to collaborate by fax. That's okay by me. So I said, yes, I do. And he then explained that he was doing a scavenger hunt and that he wanted one of the aunt's clues to be a very long number.
Yes.
And people would look at it and go, that's a telephone number. And they'd eventually work out it was a telephone number. They'd go to the telephone, then ring it. It would be my fax machine, which would give this strange noise, which was then a very strange noise, that strange... That's exactly.
Yeah.
Which was a most alien noise to people who'd never heard of fax machine, or certainly a modem, which was to come later.
Well, it was more extreme than a 56K dial-up. Yeah,
exactly. but his correct guess would be that someone would go, oh, I know what that is. That's a fax machine, and Steve's got one in his den. And they would and the idea was that they would then run to Steve's fax machine, write, do you have something for us or equivalent, fax it to my fax machine. And I would fax back to them something that Steve had already faxed to me, which was the next clue. So, but and Steve being Steve was just very kind of on the case. I wouldn't say neurotic about it, but he did call me every sort of half hour. You're not going to go out. You do know it'll be late. It'll be 4 in the afternoon in Connecticut, which it'll be 9, 10 or something in England, and you're not going to fall asleep. Or, you know, I said, no. I'm going to be in. I'll be reading a book. I'll be perfectly happy. I'll be next to the machine as soon as it makes a noise. And I just happened to remember that the book was Atlas Shrugged. And if ever a book was designed to send someone to sleep, it was that. The pomposity, the grandiosity of it. I mean,
you pressed on to the end, though.
No, I'm afraid I never got to the end. I still see on the tube, in London, or the subway, as you would say. I still see people reading Ayn Rand. There still is an audience for her, and there
was actually a film adaptation.
Brand
too.
Of libertarianism is still quite quite popular.
Yes,
it's very odd. I can't work it out. I don't see the joy in it, or indeed the generosity, or the love in it. I mean, I can sort of read the Communist Manifesto and say, you know, it's deluded, it's this, it's but it sort of hopes for something. It wants something. And yes, of course, it goes wrong, and of course, Stalin is the result, or whatever. I can't read Mein Kampf and see anything other than mania, and that's fine. But with Ayn Rand, I can't read anything other than mania either. Really, there's a sort of hatred of ordinary people in there.
Yeah.
I mean, this individualism taken to a pitch that is simply sick.
Yeah.
And yet I see the kind of people I see reading it, oddly enough. You're talking about the New York Library, and there's a sort of image, isn't there, in the summer of a girl in long hair sitting on the steps reading Flaubert or something.
Yeah.
That is a very romantic image of what being a student should be. You know, you should be reading your first Flaubert or your first whatever, you know. And it's often it is young girls of 21 or 22 who I see seriously reading this absolutely bewilderingly deluded drivel.
Yeah,
in my opinion. Now, probably some of them listening are members of the Rand Corporation, which still exists and still presumably has enormous power and outreach, and indeed with the Tea Party, who will think that it's typical of me. It's interesting that she was Jewish, of course, we were talking about.
Well, I mean, human beings are driven to extremity. I mean, in your book, it is a collection of addictions to a large degree,
yes,
of sugar, of cigarettes, of technology. How does one balance a more reasonable addiction with, I suppose, the more extreme one that we're talking about with Ayn Rand? Is it a matter of just having empathy for other people, or what of this?
I don't know. It's a really interesting point that, it may be that one can coldly and rationally try and define life, to objectify, which is her point, life into a series of goals in which the individual supreme goals of the individual must always take precedence over the inefficiency and annoyance and wickedness and stupidity, airheadedness of society, but that's it's sort of what Aristotle would call a false category. I mean, that's not the only way you can look at being human. You're either an individual or you're a member of a hive. There's a lot in between. You can be an individual who is a member of a hive. You can be a totally social being. We all are social. I mean, as Aristotle said, man is a political animal. It was the most famous phrase he ever gave. To me, I do like reading philosophers. I don't understand them all. You know, I start off a bit of Kierkegaard, then I have to turn two pages back and remind myself. I can read Kant quite easily in his easy bits, but then he gets difficult. And when it gets to symbolic logic, I'm utterly lost. So that's difficult. But I can read...
There's the behavioural thrust of Hume.
He's
very readable.
Very, yeah. Both Humes, actually. I also like T.E. Hume.
Yeah.
In the end, I'm a milksop liberal, hand-wringing, wet, and to me there are small words. You know, T. Hume, actually, since you mentioned him, you mentioned A. Hume, you meant David Hume, but T. Hume, who was a slightly less well-known philosopher poet who died in the First World War, but was a huge influence on Pound and Fenollosa and the what you might call the founders of modernism, really. He railed against him in his early work, what he called the capital letter moralists, people who use words like justice, mercy, right, goodness, with a capital letter, as if they had an absolute meaning. And he said it's like to me. It's you know, it's like saying here's a $7.5 bill. It's you know, I don't recognize that, York. When you say freedom, it doesn't mean what I mean by freedom, you know. And he also talked about, I think the phrase he used was life being a concrete flux of interpenetrating intensities, which is one of those great phrases that sounds just rhythmically so beautiful. But in other words, what he was basically saying is that we aren't nouns. We are verbs. We are ongoing processes as people. We are not things. And actually, doctors to this day will tell you they're now trained. When someone says, "Oh, I'm a diabetic," they go, "No. You have type 2 diabetes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or there's I'm an asthmatic. No, you are prone to episodes of asthma." You know, no one is a noun. You know, doctors are told that actually it's undignified, it's inaccurate, and it's also sort of, as it were, clinically deleterious to call people by their condition as if that's who they or what they are. So to me, all the big words shrink next to little words like kindness. Kindness and cheerfulness and things like that. Now it's very hard to write a book. You're not going to get taught by university philosophers if you just say, "Oh, I think everyone should be very nice to each other and be kind."
Yes.
And I think people should be cheerful. It's not really much of a philosophy, you know. And yet it is. It's enormous. It's an enormous thing. Cheerfulness, enormous. I mean, and if you wanted to get intellectual about it, you could say there was the Greek movement of eudaimonism, which was essentially was about that. It was about the sense of good nature, being a transmissible benign disease. I remember a mad cartoon from years and years ago where somebody wakes up and he reads in his newspaper over breakfast, "If you are nice to the first 10 people you meet and put them in a good mood, they will be nice to the 10 people they meet in a good mood." And by lunchtime, the world will be in a good mood.
And
he goes out of his house and he goes to the first person, "Howdy, neighbor, it's great to see you, you're looking wonderful." And the fellow goes, "Get away from me, you freak."
Yeah.
And that's basically the problem. That's where the theory kicks up against reality.
Well, this seems a good segue into what you write in the book, this sort of aborted career as a book reviewer. Mm. You point out that you had a book that was identified as the stinker.
Mm.
And you wrote the most vituperative, mean-spirited attack piece on this book, and you felt awful about this. And this may also tie into what you said also in the book about, you know, artists having the need for artists to have thick skin versus thin skin actually having a sensitivity. Mm. I'm curious, what do you do for, I suppose, a critical culture that exists? I mean, do you have Artist Awareness Day? Or do you have sort of happy place?
No.
I mean, it kind of ties into this last thing.
I mean, I'm completely wrong. Yeah. People are allowed to.
Yeah.
I mean, I go out of a movie house and I say that was a piece of shit, wasn't it? That was an awful movie.
Yeah.
Or what a dreadful performance. Or God, I hated that. Or I will leave things at half time. Or I won't tweet it.
Yes.
I don't want to hurt anyone's feelings. I'm, in that sense, I'm a complete coward. I mean, I might accidentally hurt someone's feelings, but I don't think I ever deliberately do. And it may be, and this is the thing I wrestle with in a book, that I don't do it because I can't bear to think that people might imagine that I'm an unpleasant person.
Yeah.
That it's actually a kind of selfishness. Mm-hmm. It's not really because I'm lovely and I'm just a fluffy, gorgeous bunny rabbit of a loveliness. It may just be that I can't bear to be thought of as someone, whereas I know lots of people whom I quite like who are very rude and brusque with people.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, I knew Alec Guinness a little, the actor who people will know as Obi-Wan Kenobi, of course.
I love the Elon. And
I remember going around with him backstage. We went to the theatre to see something together, and he went around backstage and he said, "Well, you were very, very bad indeed."
Jeez.
Well, it was like that, but I'm afraid you were, and I think you know it. And
for Alec Guinness in that sonorous voice to deliver that assessment.
It's quite hard. Now, you know, I've been round backstage and I've lied to every actor. The best one I ever had was a friend of mine, an actor called Paul Eddington, who was a wonderful comic actor, and he got to play a part he'd always wanted to play, which was that of Crocker Harris in the Browning version by Terence Rattigan, a played twice memorably on film by Michael Redgrave and Albert Finney. And it's a wonderful, wonderful role that I hope one day to play myself. It's about a failure. It's a dried up, terrible failure of a schoolmaster. And he played it and Olivier was in the audience. He knew Olivier was in the audience. And Olivier was, you know, towards the end of his life then, but as Paul said, you know, to go on stage in a major role, the title role of a, well, not the title role, it was the Browning version. It's actually the Browning's translation of the Oresteia. So it's, Robert Browning is the title, and he's not even in the play. But anyway, the lead character, and know that Olivier's in the audience. And Olivier came round afterwards, not to the dressing room door. I said, "What did Olivier say?" And Peter, but Paul Ellington said, "He said," and he laughed because he could only laugh at such a thing. He said, "I'm so glad I saw that."
Yes.
Was there ever more? Talk about, it's not even damning with faint praise. It's just, I'm so glad I saw that. It's just, I mean, God, that's the best you can come up with.
Yeah.
But bless him. Talking of it, just reminded me, I don't know why it's not really relevant to the book, but I know I'm supposed to be here selling a book. Although I am a whore, I'm a terrible whore because I am, you know, I should
how
be
so?
I should be selling, I should be saying buy the book. Well, I just have, there you go. There's a line in the Browning version which every year that passes I think is truer. The character of Crocker Harris has a wife who is having an affair with one of the other teachers of this school. And she's a bitch. She's very hard to like in the play. And the youngish master she's having an affair with is slightly more likable, but obviously a cad because he's screwing his colleague's wife. And there's one bit where the one nice thing that has happened to this dried-up old schoolmaster is that a schoolboy has given him a copy that he's found. It's not really worth much, but he's found it in a second-hand bookshop of Browning's translation of the Oresteia, the Browning version of the Oresteia. And he's a classics teacher, a very dry classics teacher. And he looks at it and he says, "Oh, it's very good, you'll enjoy it." He says, no, this is for you, sir, it's a present. He said, "Really, for me?"
Yeah.
And he has to turn away to cry. I'm doing it now because no one has ever been so nice to him in all his life as this boy giving him this present, and it touches him so deeply. A man who has become so dried up over 40 or 50 years of teaching, dully teaching, badly, and he knows it, not inspiring people. You can teach Aeschylus in such a way as to inspire them. These are fiery and remarkable pieces of work, but if it was all about the rhythm, it was all about the... Not exactly. Leluo is the middle of Luo, is ransom Leluain, and, you know, it was all utterly the most... And he was... But this boy was just sweet-natured and wanted to give him a present because it was his last term. And it also so happened that the wife knew that the boy needed to know his results early for some reason, just so that he could know which school he was going to next or whether he got a place in university or something. Anyway, there's a silence at a lunch where the man who's having an affair with his wife is, and his wife, and Crocker Harris says, very shyly, "A rather wonderful thing happened to me this morning. So that boy, Taplow, gave me a book, a present. It was the Oresteia, the Browning version." And she says, "Oh, the sneaky little devil. I know exactly why he did that." And she then proceeds basically to take away every nice thing about it. And it's a devastating moment of cruelty. It sounds so silly, so small and so parochial, and yet that was the genius of him, as it was the genius of Chekhov and the genius of Jane Austen. It doesn't matter what the milieu is. Within a tiny and weird milieu, you can have the most powerful passions running.
Yeah.
And anyway, So Crocker Harris goes away deeply upset, and more importantly, the master sees the girl who's having the wife that he's having an affair with in new eyes, as a horrible woman, more screwed up really than Crocker Harris is. So he goes after him, and he says to him, "Listen, Crocker Harris, old man," he says, "you mustn't pay any attention to what she says. We all think she's dreadful. I don't know how you put up with her. We actually admire the fact that you put up with such a dreadful woman." Mm-hmm. And Crocker Harris turns to him and says, "My dear fellow, I know you mean well, but never, never presume to understand another man's marriage." Mm-hmm. Isn't that a fantastic... fantastic thing to say. And you know, when I first saw that play, I must have been about 12, and I think it was Alan Bedell playing the part, somebody like that playing on a BBC version of it. It was being done. Then I saw the Redgrave film, and I've seen the Redgrave film Time Out of Mind, and I've seen the Albert Finney film a couple of times. But the longer you live, the more you realise what an extraordinary truth that is. Never presume to presume is exactly the right verb.
Judgment.
Never presume to understand another man's marriage. You know, you might think, oh, I do feel sorry for her. Yeah. He bullies her so badly. Or I do feel so sorry for him. Or I do. But never presume to understand another man's marriage. And in fact, they needed each other. That's the weird thing about the play. Although he is a terrible failure, those two did need each other. And they go off. And although the film ends with him. I'm almost crying at the memory of him just standing up, making his speech, in which he says, I'm sorry.
Never presume to understand, I suppose, the critical establishment, which is to tear into art. Never presume to understand extremism. Never presume to understand things that are put out into the world with some cruelty in mind.
Attempt to understand.
But I mean, I'm wondering if it's a feeling that we could ever understand. I mean, is it because we're dealing with, I suppose, almost a polar type?
That's why we have ethics. Yes. That's why we have ethics. That's why ethics needs to be taught. I mean, you may say that it is an absolute evil. To use the opposite of that wonderful phrase in the book Schindler's Ark that became the film Schindler's List, where Stern pulls out the list after typing it and he waves it in front of Schindler's face and says, this is an absolute good.
Yes.
It's a wonderful line. But you may say it's an absolute evil to put a nail bomb in a public restaurant where ordinary members of the public dine and then explode it. There could be children and women in there. You may say that is never anything but evil. And most of us would agree. Mm-hmm. Well, the British supplied the French resistance with precisely the equipment to do exactly that in Paris, in restaurants, where, yes, German officers consorted with collaborationists, but also ordinary members of the public could go. So perhaps the British Army, the British Special Operations Executive, who were responsible for doing that, for helping the French resistance to try and disrupt Germany's rule, its Reich, its over France, were as evil as Al Qaeda. It's a puzzler. It means we're saying there isn't an absolute evil because, from our point of view, the French Resistance are heroes. We gave them medals. We think of them as brave and extraordinary people who risked their lives to sabotage trains and put bombs in restaurants and do things that we and the IRA thought of themselves as freedom fighters and we thought of them as brutes.
Yes.
And the same with in South Africa, they thought of the ANC as and so on. And in some cases, you can say, well, this is more right than that. In this case, there is some right on this side and some right on that side. The fact is, it may even be that there's never an absolute good or an absolute evil.
Yeah.
And then there's nothing that annoys a right-wing person more than to say that there is not an absolute anything because they'll say, moral relativism, that isn't the enemy. Yeah. That isn't the enemy of the 20th century. That isn't what socialism and liberalism has led us to. That isn't what has led to the breakup of the family. And that isn't what is no certainty, no more certainty anymore. But who can be morally certain? Who dares be?
Well, I actually have been wanting to ask you about this, your zeal for Apple.
Yes.
There is recently a very moving This American Life segment where it revealed the abuses by Foxconn, Chinese workers who were committing suicide.
Yes, it was revealing how little they mentioned Sony, how little they mentioned Nokia, how little they mentioned Dell, how the only company they wanted you to hear about was Apple, who actually make the minority of equipment made there.
Yes.
Because Apple has the name it has. Now, had this happened in 1996, when Apple was on the floor, when it was dead, when I remember as an Apple fan being told, when you want your next Apple fix, you'll have to go to a hobby shop because there won't be an Apple computer in 1997, which is the year Steve Jobs returned. And Apple was the underdog. Isn't it? It's now the overdog. So now when Foxconn is shown to have these suicides and things like that, it's where the iPad is made. It's where the iPhone is made. They don't mention it's also where the Nokia is made, where the Sony is made, where the Dell is made.
But that still doesn't disabuse us of the problem.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
But why choose it? Why would you instantly make it Apple. I tell you why, because Apple has become a symbol in the same way that Ford became a symbol, in the way, quite literally, in Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, he has AF after Ford. He changed the world. He was instead of... And yes, I am certainly not defending the practice. The fact is you can afford an iPhone because... But go... as Johnny Ive does all the time, to Foxconn, go there. It has to be said, Apple have addressed this better than other companies. Microsoft has attempted to do it, but you look through the history of it. I mean, there will always be Apple haters, and there will always be people who perceive me as being just, you know, whatever Apple does is always must be right. Yeah. It's just that I happen to know the people who work there, and I really know how decent they are and how much they care. Certainly Johnny Ive is one of the most... lovable, adorable, moral, sane, ethical people I know. He spends a huge amount of time in China. If you ask anybody in China, do you want to work in Foxconn for 5.5 times more than you work in a factory next door, they will say, yes, please. The fact is, it's a huge factory, and there have been these terrible suicides and things, does not mean that it is Auschwitz. Now, you know, the fact is, it makes a great story.
Now we're getting into Godwin territory.
It makes a great story. That your iPod is filled with the blood of Chinese workers. If there were no iPods and no iPads, China would be a great deal poorer and there would be a lot more death and a lot more starvation. There would be more famine. Now, I'm not, you know, I'm not justifying it as a result. I would love to think that iPods could be made in America.
Yeah.
And they could be made at a price that then you pay, say, £3,000 for your iPhone. Probably $3,000, perhaps, would be the equivalent. I'd love to think America could grow its economy in the next few weeks so that the Apple could do that.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they'd love to be able to do it as well. But
we can't just look the other way.
No, we're not. Yeah. We're talking about it. Yeah. And Apple is talking about it more than most. And they have, you know, they have really gone into the ethics of this, and they have produced reports, and they've said it is not good enough, and they have looked at it. And I mean, you can go on the websites, and you know, some of them will be anti-Apple and say, oh, yes, but Microsoft have also looked at it. They've tried to do things about it as well. Nokia makes some of their stuff in Finland, but they also make a great deal of their stuff at Foxconn, at that same factory, as do Dell, as do other computer makers. But it's always Apple which would be the name there, because and even though Apple doesn't even have the biggest market share, they don't. Apple has a tiny market share. They just happen to make a fuck of a lot of money.
Yeah, but is it an inescapable aspect of industrialization? I suppose there's nothing really we can do about it.
Well, I mean, look at the jeans you're wearing, the shirt you're wearing. Yeah, do you know how they're made? I don't know. I mean, yes, I guess we're all absolutely. I had great 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 grandfathers who stirred sugar into their coffee, knowing that both were picked by slaves.
Yeah.
Were they evil people? I don't know. I don't think they were. I think they tried to be good.
Yeah.
And the point about morality is it's not fixed.
Sure.
Ethics maybe, but morality isn't. Morality is just a word for custom. Yeah. The Latin for custom. It's the way we do things. And it was, you know, the custom was that for one man to have sexual relations with another 50 years ago was evil, perverted, and either needed chemical castration or imprisonment as a punishment. It's now considered by all, except some very weird people, it has to be said, I think, really, to be considered a pretty natural form of life. In fact, there are, the last count, I think it was something like 427 species of animal that exhibit homosexual behaviour. There's only one species that exhibits homophobic behaviour, and that's man. So if we're going to talk about what's natural, I think we can basically say...
I'm running out of time, but I want to sneak in one question. I have to say that Simon Raven, Alms for Oblivion, I had no real idea of who he was, and your book actually got me to purchase the Omnibus.
So please.
So I have to know, why is he? Because you're making some very extravagant claims, like, yeah, he's bigger than Paul.
He's not bigger, he just said, I prefer him.
Why is he better than Paul for you?
Because I find Paul a rather tight-assed snob.
Oh,
whereas I find, although Simon Raven is also a snob, he's a wide-assed snob. It's a very weird way of looking at it.
It all comes out of the asses.
It's England. There's a generosity, a magnificence about Simon Raven.
Yeah.
It's also about a group, a closed sodality of people who started like, I mean, they're very clay, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't known society, you'll know who a lot of the characters are based on.
Yes.
It's a sequence of 12 novels based, it comes from a quotation from from Taurus and Cressida, Act 3, Scene 3. Time hath my lord a wallet at his back where he keeps arms for oblivion, the great-sized monster of ingratitude, which, oddly enough, is the line we used in the sketch, me and Hugh Laurie, many years ago in a Shakespeare masterclass thing. But I just find, as someone once said, he has the pen of an angel and the mind of a devil.
I'm so close to the bottom.